Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's get this session underway. Kerry Helenius has some decades of experience, and it's quite diverse experience as well. So you've got life insurance and superannuation and education, but what's really relevant today, he's got some very interesting experience in the investment banking world. So he was an executive director of investment banking with Goldman Sachs J.B. Weir. He was an equity partner with J.B. Weir, and he's a very accomplished, or was a very accomplished, investment analyst. So he's very well credentialed to talk about this particular topic. So with that, Kerry, I'll hand over to you.
I'm very passionate about this topic. I'll get started. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is CPI indexation and using various investment strategies and see how well they can support CPI indexed drawdowns. The data I'm using is Colin Grenfell's OSMOD model, which is now a database that goes from June 1959 to March 2025. So it's a really rich database that has 15 investment and economic sectors, including the ones listed up there, but also, obviously CPI. It's based on around very representative unit price data, and it allows for imputation credits, and it allows for investment charges in the analysis. And so you can use that data to recreate balanced funds, capital stable funds, growth funds, and look at specific sector funds as well. So the fact that it's got the 65-year history, to me, the quote from Warren Buffett is very relevant, where the rearview mirror is always clearer than the windshield. And when you've got that depth of data going back, it becomes very insightful. Okay, so when we look at the challenge, retiree funds in Australia are approaching 1.5 trillion or greater than 1.5 trillion on some measures, depends on how you count it. And there is a need, we all know, for innovative, flexible, sustainable, long-term retiree income solutions. And within that, CPI indexation is a key component if you want to maintain purchasing power. But there's also a need for CPI indexation in other industries, across the life insurance and general insurance industry. There's liabilities that do increase with CPI. And I'll show you some of the data, but investments seem to have exceeded CPI quite easily. But the problem is, if you use that past 65 years of data and you look at a balanced fund, it's failed 36% of the time to deliver a CPI indexed income stream starting at 5% over a 30-year period. But to me, that's a very high failure rate from using a balanced fund. Okay, so this is just deterministic calculations, but it does get to the heart of how you can look at this problem, and that is that essentially you have a drawdown rate. Once you set that drawdown rate, which is the percentage of the fund that you want to start your income stream at, after that's been set, it's fixed because it goes up from that point with CPI every year. So you don't have the flexibility to move that around. You set your drawdown rate. Once it's set, CPI indexation will continue to just increase that accordingly. And this chart shows that as you increase your initial drawdown rate across the left-hand side down the bottom, you'll need a higher return above CPI from your investment returns to support it. It's pretty self-explanatory. So at a 5% drawdown rate, if you had uniform investment returns and uniform inflation rates, you'd need a 3% gap to support an initial 5% drawdown rate to make it last for the 30-year period. If you didn't have any gap, you could draw out at 3.3% and index that with inflation, and the capital would be consumed over the 30 years. So that's a useful sort of reference point to start looking at the analysis. The first problem is that we don't get uniform rates of return in the real world, and inflation certainly hasn't been uniform. Inflation's varied from minus 0.7% to 18% over the last 65 years. And so then if you're trying to get a gap above that, it's not really very easy to get a sustainable gap above inflation when inflation can vary at those sort of rates. And over a 30-year period, if you started with, say, a $25,000 payment now, it would have either doubled in the lowest case, and that was just a few years ago, to about 50,000, or it could be a sevenfold increase up to 170,000. And so you don't know in nominal dollars how much you're going to have to pay out into the future. It could vary a lot, but it's always going up. So this illustrates that you do need a different approach to decumulation than accumulation. So this shows a $500,000 starting point from 1972. It's going into the history. It's one example, but it highlights the point. And there was a very 72 was a very significant period, because it's probably one of the biggest starting points to a decline that we had in the market over 2 years, over 73, 74. And if we look at the purple line is the cumulative inflation, CPI. The red line is an accumulation fund. I haven't put in any tax, I haven't put in any contributions, but it shows that over time, after 13 years, the red line gets above inflation. So on the accumulation phase, a balanced fund has done okay in the long run. Took a while, but it eventually exceeded the cumulative inflation, and so you're actually doing okay. The blue line is the same scenario, balanced fund. This time I've got the 5% drawdown rate in there, indexed to inflation. And it goes negative after 16, 17 years. So it hasn't sustained the payments. So on the accumulation side, yeah, we did okay with a balanced fund. On the decumulation side, we didn't achieve our objective of getting to 30 years. And I could show you many other examples that are similar. Okay, but this shows what the real issue is. And the real issue is sequencing risk. So the order of returns is much more important than the average value of the returns. So that orange line there, these all have 5% drawdowns indexed to inflation. But the orange line has used the average investment return over 30 years and the average inflation rate over 30 years. And you can see it increases quite nicely. So you think, on the average, we should do okay. As I showed you before, the blue line goes negative. So that's the real returns and the real inflation rates coming through, not the averages, and you're running out of money after 16 years. Interestingly, if you would have moved everything forward just by 1 year, you get the green line, which shows an increasing account balance going through. So the order of when you get your investment returns and when you're hit with poor investment returns and inflation is really important. So you can't really derive a CPI indexing investment strategy unless you have a solution for sequencing risk. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll show you how some of the investment sectors have gone versus CPI first without drawdowns, and I'll show you how well they can sustain margins above CPI. And then I'll add in drawdowns and look at various investment strategies. And I'll look at how successful they've been in reaching a 30-year mark. And if they reach a 30-year mark, what's left over at the 30-year point? And I'll also look at when they fail, what sort of durations do you get when they fail? But first, we'll start off just by looking at some of the investment sectors versus CPI. And the most significant sector to talk about is cash, because cash and CPI are very closely related. Reserve banks use cash rates to control inflation. So it's not a surprise that there'd be a relationship there. If you look at the history, the green line is about 1990. So on the left-hand side of the green line, we have orange and blue lines. The blue lines are unit price returns from cash, but they're a good proxy for cash rates. And the orange line is inflation. So prior to 1990, you could see we had this high inflation, high interest rate environment. After 1990, you can see a much lower inflation rate, much lower cash rate environment. The other interesting thing is you can see that the blue line trails the orange line a little bit, and that makes sense. Inflation goes up, then the Reserve Bank takes some action. And if you look at it just on a normal basis, the correlation is 64% between the cash and CPI index. And anything above 30%, you'd start to say, well, that looks significant. This is 64%, so it's a high correlation here between cash and CPI. If we lag the cash rate by 6 months or lag inflation by 6 months, we basically get a 68% correlation. So it improves when we sort of, as you as you'd expect, that the cash rate, when you actually move it back in line by 6 months, it gets closer. So it shows that cash is a good starting point. Interestingly, at the right-hand side, that's March 2025. We're not that far away from where we were in 1959 in terms of where the inflation rate and where the cash rates are sitting. So the question is, what happens for the next 30 years? I don't have the answer. I don't know. But it is worth looking at these periods where inflation has gone up to high levels, especially when you have Trump talking about tariffs and things like that. So it's a useful analysis to complete. It's not just an assumption that inflation will continue to be low. So it's worthwhile analysing the history around this. Okay, now this chart shows you the average gaps between investment sectors and CPI. And this is out of the Osmot database. So shares on the left-hand side there, 7.9% gap on average to CPI. And as we go across, we basically get down the other end, international bonds and cash at about 2.2% gap to CPI over the 65-year history. If we take the 30-year averages, yeah, similar sort of pattern, but you can see the cash goes up a little bit and the shares have come down a little bit, but they're broadly sort of comparable. In the middle there, I show the balanced fund, and that's got about a 5% gap to CPI on average. So you think 5% gap, great, fantastic. But even when we assume a 5% drawdown rate, and go back to that chart, that equates to a 3% uniform gap, we get a failure rate of 36%. So again, it goes back to sequencing risk. The averages don't work. Sequencing risks, the order of how investment returns come through, is really critical. Okay, and how they work, this shows, it's a very busy slide, but it's each of the investment sectors is basically listed here. And along the bottom, I've got time periods from 1 to 30 years. And then I've got the success rate here of did this sector beat CPI, or what percentage of times did it beat CPI? So you can see nothing on the left-hand side beat CPI 100% of the time. The best outcomes were above 85%. The lowest were about 65%. All the way along, everything at least was above 50% all the way through. And you can see they trend up. Property, this is direct property, did the best. It was the blue line. It hit the 100% mark quickest. After 13 years, it was basically, and 13 years and beyond, every cumulative 13-year period and beyond, it was beating CPI. Interestingly, a lot of people use fixed interest as, you know, a really core part of their income products. It was the only sector that didn't achieve the 100% success rate. It was still a failure at the 30-year point, where there was one 30-year period where it didn't actually meet CPI. And you can sort of see that red line, it sort of trails down fairly low. It's not been a really good basis for matching CPI. The orange line, which is, or the yellow line there, which is cash, sorry, cash has done, you know, far better than fixed interest in matching CPI. Okay, if we now stress test this a little bit and say we don't want just to match CPI, we want to get returns above CPI. So here we're looking at a 3% gap above CPI, and you can see there's only two things that achieved it. The green line, which was Australian shares, and that did it after 25-year periods, and the balanced fund mix, which achieved it for 29-year periods and beyond. So the last couple of years it was getting 100% success rate. Everything else was below 100% success rate once we got to the 30-year mark and all the way along from 0 to 30 years. That's why you have a bit of a challenge in trying to get CPI indexed income streams, because a lot of the asset classes, once you start to push to levels beyond CPI, they struggle to sort of be able to support it. If we push it further and look at a 4.5% gap to CPI, the only thing that achieved it was shares, Australian shares, and achieved it after 26-year periods. The balanced fund only had a 72% success rate in achieving CPI with a 4.5% gap above CPI along the journey. And remember, we started talking about property being the best in matching CPI. It's now the worst with the 4.5% gap. So that blue line down the bottom is property, and cash actually does a little bit better than property, even at that level, but it's down to about a 10% success rate. So these sectors all have different characteristics. They all behave in different ways. And when you start to have different objectives of different gaps to CPI, they behave differently. Shares is quite good. It does quite a good job consistently. Okay, now let's start to look at putting in drawdowns, because that's what it's all about. It's trying to find strategies to match CPI index drawdowns. So we'll look at the success and failure rates across those investment sectors. Then we'll look at some various investment strategies, some common investment strategies that are sort of out there. I'll talk a little bit about this approach, which I call the dynamic approach versus the static investment approaches, and I'll explain what that's about. Then we'll look at the durations that you can achieve from your various drawdown strategies. And because I've got a 30-year time frame, if I do reach 30 years, it's important to look at what's left behind at the 30-year mark in the account. So this table shows us the... So this is where I'll start. This is where the various investment sectors, we're looking at their failure rates when you add in drawdowns. So along the bottom there, we've got 4%, 5% through to 8% drawdown rates as our starting point. Once we have that starting point fixed, we then index it with CPI going forward. And you can see this is the various individual investment sectors, so not composite sectors here. Again, you can see shares has got a very low failure rate. It's the blue line, certainly at the 4 and 5% level. 4%, it's 100% success rate. It goes up to about 50% failure rate when you're at the 8% initial drawdown level. The purple line is cash, and you can see it does very well at the 4% drawdown rate. It virtually has very close to 100% success rate. Similarly, property, but that trajectory of the purple and the blue lines is much sharper than the others. So once you get to drawdowns of beyond 6%, they're basically the worst performing in terms of supporting CPI indexed payments. Yeah, this table just sets out the composite mixes that I use in the analysis going forward. So it has the various mixes between the various sectors for capital stable, balanced and growth fund. These are, Colin Granville uses these sort of mixes when he talks about these in his papers, and so I've just adopted those. I've also tried the CPI plus 2.5%. Now, it's close to something that's actually available in the market at the moment, but I've done a fully guaranteed 2.5% on CPI. It's interesting that these, when I talk about it, I'm talking about managing sequencing risk. Well, CPI plus 2.5% absolutely manages sequencing risk. It gives you a uniform 2.5% above inflation. So that is managing sequencing risk. So that could be good. But be aware that's not the way it does it is a little bit artificial. It's not using the investment sectors to support it. It's basically saying there's two pools of funds. One is, say, a balanced fund, and one is, say, the retirement fund. And they basically transfer the sequencing risk from the retirement fund to the accumulation fund. That's a transfer of sequencing risk as opposed to managing sequencing risk. So it's a bit of a different situation. I also look at a 50-50 mix of cash and shares. I look at 100% shares, 100% cash, and then this dynamic process that I'll touch on. Now I've flipped it around, and this chart shows you the success rates of these various strategies. And you can see the blue line is CPI plus 2.5%. As I go along, it's at 100% success rate initially, but I hit 4.75, it goes down to zero. And it makes sense because the 5% drawdown rate, if you remember, equated to a 3% uniform gap to CPI. So you can't support a 3% gap when you're only offering 2.5%. So it must fail. So therefore, beyond the 5% drawdown rates, the CPI plus 2.5% had a 100% failure rate. along the top line there, the red line is this dynamic approach that I'm talking about. It once you go beyond 5.25% drawdowns, it basically, I didn't achieve 100% success rates, but it still sits above the other sort of approaches. The green line is Australian shares, and Australian shares does very well as well. You can see the downward trend on all those sectors as you increase your initial drawdown rate, which is what you'd expect. Okay, so why is that dynamic approach? Why is it sitting above these others? So what the dynamic approach does, there's only a few variables you can play with here. Once you've set your drawdown rate, it's set. It's going to go up with CPI after that. You can't move that around. If you have a static investment approach, a balanced fund or composite fund, it rebalances back to those set investment weights each time. So again, no wriggle room. You can't really play around with that too much. Therefore, if those static approaches fail, they'll all fail. They'll all go down, especially around this time, around anything in the lead up to the 1970s was a very terrible time because it hit the 1970s. But these three examples are different starting points. The data is always completely different because I'm looking at December, December, March, March, June, June. They're three distinct data sets, but they all have this high inflation period within them. What the dynamic approach says is, okay, what have we got to play with? We can't play with the drawdown rate. If we've got a static investment mix, we're stuck. The only option we really have is to change our investment mix, because that's the only thing we can do to potentially support our CPI index payments better. And the thing I was sort of quite proud of is I did it with a preset rule. So it's not a subjective process. It's not each year making a decision to say, what do we do now with the benefit of, you know, benefit of foresight, because I've got the history in the database. This rule just basically said, look at the history. As per Warren Buffett, the history is much clearer than the future. Based on the history, then let's make an investment decision. And it's doing it according to a preset rule. And that preset rule has effectively lifted the tail in all those scenarios. So the purple line is the dynamic approach. It actually had increasing accumulation balances, even with the drawdowns going through, whereas the other approaches there all were sort of going into negative territory before the 30-year mark. Okay, so how long do these payments last? As I said, on a 5% drawdown rate, that dynamic approach had 100% success rate. So it sits along the top. Every occurrence was at least 30 years. So it ran along the top. The next line down is the CPI plus 2.5%. So you think, that's pretty good. But bear in mind, anything below the 30-year mark means all your capital has been consumed. So, yes, it reaches 28 and 29 years, but it reaches it and then that's it. There's nothing left over. The account has gone to zero. The other investment approaches all eventually move up to, you know, this is done on percentiles, by the way. So this is the percentiles of all the historical occurrences. And you can see that the balanced fund, being the blue line, light blue line there, it reaches the 30-year mark. And that's where I get my 36% success rate, because you have to go up to the 36th percentile before you actually start to get positive balances, and then it's positive thereafter. So each of them, you know, eventually will trend up. This has been ranked from worst to best results. The only one that did best was the dynamic approach. In terms of duration, CPI plus 2.5% did quite well, but remember, nothing was left over. And then if you look at the bottom chart, it's doing the same thing, but with an 8% initial drawdown rate. And there, the CPI plus 2.5% just consistently gave you 16 years, no matter when you started or when you finished it, it just consistently gave you 16. And 16 is good in the worst occurrences, because all the other lines sit below 16. But once you get beyond about 20%, 80% of the occurrences, you're better off with any of the other investment strategies. Okay, my final chart. This one, if you see black is bad. If you see blue is good. What they are is the black shows the accounts have run out by the 30-year mark. So on the top chart there, you can see CPI plus 2.5%, 100% black, there was nothing that reached 30 years, so there was no money left at the 30-year mark, so it was 100% black. As you move across, you see there's gradually sort of stepping up, and at the right-hand side is the dynamic approach, which was 100% success rate, so everything had something left. You had a balance at the 30-year mark. Where it's blue, it says you've actually created wealth. CPI adjusted, the account balance was more than what you started with. So here you can have an approach which gives you the highest drawdown rate with the dynamic approach, but also gave you an account balance that 72% of the time exceeded your original starting point when you CPI adjusted it. Like, it, to me, it looks pretty good. Shares does that pretty well too, mind you, but it did have a 4% failure rate for 5% failure rate for shares. But 78% of those balances still exceeded what you started with. The pure 50-50 mix, just pure 50-50 of cash and shares, still did better than shares on its own and did better than a balanced fund in terms of its success rates and in terms of what was left over. So that was also quite interesting. Okay, so I think, I don't know how long I've been going, but I've been racing through. But so I get to my conclusions. And sequencing risk is the key risk. If you can manage sequencing risk, you have to do that as your starting point. Because if you can do that as your starting point, then the investment sectors do have margins above CPI and you can start to implement them. But you've got to prepare for the big event before it happens. You do need a different investment approach. If you use the same investment approach for accumulation in decumulation phase, it will fail quite a large percentage of time if we end up having similar scenarios to the 1970s where we have the high inflation, high interest rate type scenarios where investment sectors all do poorly. You might say, that won't happen again. Well, that's fine. You don't have to, but it's good to sort of analyze that and prepare for that sort of occurrence. And sort of be aware of that situation. You can either improve your success rates by lowering your drawdown rate, so that's giving less income to over that 30-year period. That's sort of suboptimal. The aim is to sort of maximize your income, not to minimize it, but that would work. And the other thing is changing the investment strategy along the way. If you don't change the investment strategy along the way, you will get high failure rates. It's very dangerous in just using averages, because the averages might look good, but it's the sequencing of those returns that is the critical thing. And yeah, it is a simple rule, you can actually get around it and get 100% success rates. So it is possible. So you can explore your various options out there, but I think this gives you a bit of a framework for how you can sort of set up your analysis as well. Is there anything else that I wanted to say? I did want to say that I've ignored age pension here entirely. It's just purely being based off drawdowns and investment returns. In our session after lunch, Ian and I have got another session on optimizing account-based pensions, and we do include some analysis there on pensions, and pensions makes a huge difference to what you can get out of these sort of approaches as well. So, with that... hand back maybe to Ian, and happy to take any questions.
So, guys, put your questions into the system or grab the microphone if you like. While we're waiting, Kerry, can you make some comments on the peculiarities of the Australian market that helps with these outcomes?
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll see a few bits of paper around the room, and on one of those, it's sort of got the recent research that both Colin and I have done around the Australian sector, especially on the shares, and negative autocorrelations in the Australian share market. And it sort of sounds like, what's that mean? But it's actually really, really significant. Australian share market in the early lags has got negative autocorrelations, which you don't see in the other sectors. So shares have got an average return of around 13% over that time frame. But because of these negative autocorrelations, it actually means you keep on being forced back on a regular statistical basis to get those returns. Whereas if you have positive autocorrelations, the trends continue for a long period of time. So you can get negative trends for a long period of time, positive trends for a long period of time. In shares, yes, they're volatile, but you keep on getting back on trend very quickly. So that's actually really important. And why it happens is the Australian market, I like using this, we're only the size of an apple. We're actually smaller than Apple in terms of the whole size of the Australian market. So the cash flows, international cash flows that come in and can shake our market around are far greater than what you can see happening in the US market, where you will see longer positive autocorrelations in those returns.
Okay, thanks. You want to ask your question there?
Yeah. Hello? Sorry.
Yep, sure. We can hear you.
Thanks, Kerry. Great presentation. Estelle Lee from AMP. So my question is more about, I think you demonstrated, I think, the dynamic strategy with the 30 years period in retirement, how that can actually help achieving, you know, the income goal that is unchained. But we all know, I think, in decumulation phase, so the period is uncertain. And people don't know how long they're going to draw down for.
Yep.
So is your strategy can be optimized based on, I think, you know, an uncertain period of time as well? Have you tested that?
Look, the 30 years is sort of my starting point was it was probably a fairly reasonable starting point for a lot of people, a lot of couples in retirement. But the significant thing is that's why I look at what's left in the account at the 30-year mark. So if 72% of the time you actually ended up at 30 years with more than what you started with, you can repeat this strategy for another 30 years with a higher level of income than what you started out with. So it sort of covers off longevity risk by ensuring that you get, you know, balances at the end of the 30-year mark that can support further income payments. On the flip side, though, it's not guaranteed. So there'll be some – it's a distribution. And so the average is very good, but there will be some that are sort of, you know, minimal. All of them were positive, but there'll be some that were minimal balances at the 30-year mark as opposed to sort of large balances. But, yeah, 30 years is sort of what this targets, but then it says generally there's money at the end which can be used to support income streams further. So it's not specifically addressing longevity or through pooling, but it's saying it's addressing it through the investment strategy. If you combine this with pooling, you can get even far higher income streams out from the mortality side of it as well. Yeah.
Okay. Michael, we'll come to you in a sec. There's a question here from Tim Tarvey, I think it's properly pronounced. Given the sequencing risk is difficult to manage by the general population, do you see value in a guaranteed lifetime annuity that is indexed to CPI for an average retiree? That's probably a better question for our session this afternoon. So I'm putting a plug in for our session this afternoon.
Yeah, no, that's true. And so, look, there's role for all sorts of products here. But I think the point I'm making, I guess, is that you've got to start with your investment strategy. If your investment strategy doesn't support CPI index payments and you're looking to provide CPI index payments, you have a problem. So you've got to solve that problem first. And then you can look at how you can implement that investment strategy into various sorts of products and that can either give you guaranteed income for life or give you various other alternatives.
So that leads nicely to the next question from Greg Martin. It's a simple question. What's the simple rule?
Yeah. I've spent more than 1,000 hours of work in sort of getting there, so I don't want to – I mean, I've given you the basis of how you could look at it and do it. But I don't want to sort of – I'm happy to work with anyone who wants to work it up, but I don't want to just give it away freely because I've just put so much effort into it myself.
Okay. Mike, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Great presentation, Kerry. I'm Michael Demony from KPMG. Probably relates to some of those other questions, your point around autocorrelation. So you use the OSMOD model. Have you any observations if you use some of the, you know, proprietary – ESG models like Conning or Barry Hibbert's, you know, what's driving and whether that gives different results?
Yes. Yeah. I haven't tried them. And so I would only be giving sort of like a guess, but I'm not sure that I know Colin's model, the OSMOD model, focuses on these sort of issues and looks at the correlations between the sectors and looks at the autocorrelations within the sectors. And that's important. So if the other models, assume other, distributions that are somehow not connected, then that's going to cause issues. And negative autocorrelations for the Australian shares is very different to what's observed in the US market. So if you've got models that assume the US equity market assumptions for Australian equities, then that's going to cause problems.
So a follow-up question from Greg Martin. Clear role for sequencing risk insurance, a derivative of some sort. That's a question he's saying. Is there a clear role for such insurance?
I think so. I think it's doable, very doable.
Mm. Well, that's CPI plus 2.5% in some ways, does it?
Well, CPI, yes, it does.
Yeah.
I have some issues with the 2.5% CPI only because it consumes the capital too quickly. So it does deal with sequencing risk. It does give you guaranteed sort of income streams for long periods of time. But if you want to maximize your income streams, that's where it runs into problems because it'll run out. But, yeah, it certainly deals with sequencing risk.
Okay, this is a specific question about the CPI assumption across 30 years of time, historical or perspective, and how confident is it? So I think you probably just need to repeat the factual information about the CPI history and just explain the point that all of this is based on history.
Yeah, well, this is all based on the actual 65 years of history. So this is not sort of made-up data. That's the historical CPI index going over the last 65 years. And it has varied from negative 0.7 to 18% in any particular year. Yes, look, there have been changes in economic circumstances. The Australian currency used to be pegged. It's not pegged anymore. It's a free float. So all these things make changes, make differences. But I think it's still really valuable to look at the history because I think that 1970s is pretty much a worst-case scenario, very close to a worst-case scenario. So if you can navigate that, I think you can navigate almost anything with a fairly high degree of confidence, especially given that we now have a free float currency.
Greg?
Yeah, it's probably a comment, and you can comment on it. It was, I've done my own modelling. Obviously, I'm getting closer to retirement. And not advice for anyone in the market, in the room. Max out on equities when you're 65. Sequencing risk is your biggest risk. And then sort of layer into annuities where you get bang for your buck when you're 80. But the point is you need to have confidence about having money in the tin from investment. It's not longevity. You've got to get there. It's investment. And, for this afternoon, one of my suggestions for the life insurance industry is we've got wealth protection products. We say it's 60, see you, come back when you're 80. What about sequencing risk and helping people navigate that part in the middle, which I think a collective strategy, helping people in that spot is a very important part for the market.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Sequencing risk is, to me, the biggest issue, and it's been a bit of a sleeper issue. People haven't really looked at it. Well, not much. I mean, it's clear it's out there. Investment managers all know about it, but it doesn't seem to be a bit of a real focus for, the retirement industry as such.
And Greg, with people in the zone for the assets test, a lot of that sequencing risk can be taken away through the age pension. It's a really interesting outcome. You'll see later on if you come to our session this afternoon.
I'm
promoting our session this afternoon.
Absolutely. And it probably explains why there's been a low take up in a lot of the lifetime income products, actually, because the age pension, pretty much provides you with income insurance free.
Okay, I don't have any other questions here on the machine. Any other questions before we wrap up then from the floor? No? Okay. Thank you very much, Kerry. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Pass on your thanks, Kerry.